And if you know from history,
a lot of the bigger civilizations from history, they developed among the big rivers, you know, like the Babylonian, for instance, and then the Egyptian. So we have this, an old civilization is known as the Hindu civilization, and then it came in Persian by the Hindus civilization, and also called as the Harappan civilization, because supposedly started in this town or city, that's what the, you know, one of the main cities. Yeah, but it extended from this part, which is now Pakistan. This river is mostly in Pakistan, all the way down to the west, big civilization. And they had connections, you know, all over the world. They had, you know, routes coming from the east, from the west, from the north. So that's why it's called a Hindu civilization. Why is this important? Because this is where Hinduism comes, okay? So in India, in fact, or Hinduism means the religion beyond the Indus River, okay? And so we'll get to this other river just in a moment, in a few minutes. This is another important river. It's called the Ganges. Okay, or they will call it the Ganges in India, but it's a very prominent river, as you will find out. Okay, so that's more or less the origins of Hinduism, and it's basically, you know, it's a mixture of two main cultures, the Harappan or the Indus Valley civilization, and plus the Indo-Aryan. You know, they were from came from Europe, and these were the, you know, lighter skinned people. So this is a mixture of the culture where Hinduism comes from in general. So we're talking about several, maybe about 2,000 years before Christ, more or less, when this civilization began to develop. So it's an old civilization. It's also considered one of the oldest religions, Hinduism. So along that time, there were there were hundreds of hymns, mantras, and different type of literature developed for several years, and they came to be known as the Vedas. Okay, so these Vedas, you know, were developed based on this civilization, and they came to be eventually nowadays are one of the main texts for Hinduism, and there are four main Vedas. We will see that in a moment. But these hymns were directed to, you know, thousands of deities, okay? And in fact, I'll give you the number in a minute, but every hymn, you know, there's several thousand hymns. Every hymn is directed to one specific deity. So you can imagine it's a lot of deities, okay? Or so-called deities in this religion, okay? So these mantras were to be chanted or sung in a specific occasion, and in different times when they come to worship, they're still used today. Let's see, and you mainly they're sung, you know, because they're sung in Sanskrit, which is the original language in which they were written. And nowadays, you know, if you go to a modern Hindu temple, you're gonna see only the priests know the Sanskrit. And, you know, those, the lay Indian or Hindus, rather, that come to, you know, to the temple. We'll see, we'll try to get to that in, as the class goes on. The priest, you know, in a repeat after me fashion, that's how they do it. And so he repeats in Sanskrit, they repeat after him, even they don't know what it means, but they, you know, follow his leadership. Okay? So those are the Vedas, and, Vedas are more into the ritual. What to do, what to chant, what to say, okay? But when it comes to philosophy, when you start trying to think about the meaning of life, when you start to question the rituals, when you start to, you know, to wonder about life, there's another set of writings that came after the Vedas. They're also used nowadays prominently in Hinduism, which are called the Upanishads. Upanishads, okay? They're more on the philosophy side. You see, Vedas more instruction, Upanishads more on the philosophy side of things. What does the life mean? Why are we here? What does death mean? And so on and so forth. That's what the Upanishads are. And so these were basically reformers or people who were thinking or reacting from the Vedas, and then they wrote these Upanishads. And And then nowadays, you know, the writers for Hinduism are not as important as what the truths that these writings, give us, okay? So they're more focused on the writings, and they do believe they're inspired, okay? But they focus most on the truth, mostly on the truth, okay? So there was a man named Veda Vyasa, and this man, Veda Vyasa, you see the name Veda, I met a college student, classmate of mine, her name was Veda, and, you know, I didn't know the time, I mean, if, I don't even know if he came from there or not, but I mean, maybe it's a coincidence. But this man, Veda Vyasa, he's a legendary figure in Hinduism, and he's believed to have composed the Vedas and the other sacred texts. And basically, this began as oral traditions, okay, that were passed along orally. And this man, this legendary figure, he's recognized as the one who put him together, who put him in writing, okay? So when it comes to the... Now, jumping into the deities, you know, there's a video in YouTube that says 330 million deities. And then as the speakers, you know, it's an hour-long lecture, and as the speaker begins to his lecture, he says, okay, in Hinduism, there's 330 million deities. So here's number one. So he gets quiet, and people are like, what? He said, no, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to go with 330 million deities. I'm just, you know, I'm just playing with you. But that's the reality, okay? So, but there's some that are more prominent than other ones. But something that I want to mention before, you see, this is agriculture-based, just as Egypt, just as Mesopotamia, and just as other cultures, you know, around, you know, big rivers. So what is the most important source of, you know, work for them, or income? It's agriculture. See, it's nature. So you're going to see some of the... In fact, in the Vedas, some of the deities most mentioned have to be with nature. For instance, we have one of them is called Indra. And you see, some of you know, you're familiar with some Indians. That's the way, you know, nationals of India are called Indians. Not Hindus, because not every Hindu is Indian, but most of the Indians are Hindus. So you know, you might not be comfortable with that name, but that's what they're called, Indians. I have a friend, and he's an Indian. He's a Christian Indian. He's not a Hindu Indian, if that makes sense. All right? So, but anyways, if you're acquainted with some of them, you maybe recognize some of these names, or, you know, because they use them very often. But anyways, Indra, and I believe Indra is the name of the CEO of PepsiCo, I think, if I'm not mistaken. You might Google that. I had the privilege, when I was in Mexico, I worked for PepsiCo, a branch of PepsiCo in Mexico, which, you know, makes cookies, and you can find those cookies at HEB, you know, it's a big company. So I had the privilege to have her come and do a speech for us at the company, and that was neat, you know, to meet the top person in that, you know, PepsiCo. That was interesting, but her name is Indra. So anyways, this Indra is the god who controls the weather, you see? He's going in nature, okay? There's another god called Agni, and this is the god of fire, okay? And then, you know, it has to do with incense. As you burn incense, the fire goes up, and this Agni is the one who takes the requests to those gods, to the other gods, okay? So everything has to do with fire is with Agni, okay? And then we have Vishnu, which is a prominent one also. We'll get to that one more. Just a few seconds, but, you know, he reincarnated several times, 9 times reincarnated, and four of those nine, he was a fish, a tortoise, a boar, and a lion, you see? So, you know, it has to do with nature. It was important for them. Okay, this connection between the divine and the natural was important for them. So these are three of the most mentioned in the Vedas. You see how to do with nature. Okay, we're moving along. As I mentioned, this is the Ganges River. And there's a big festival, you know, which is the Mother Ganga Festival, which commemorates the time that Mother Ganga, which is the Mother Nature, became the river, incarnated in the river. So people, they believe this river is divine, Okay, that explains what they do. You know, it's just incredible. You can see, you know, videos on YouTube and so on. There's you know, Hindu, the Indians were Hindu, that they really support this view. There's all the Indians that are more objective, and they say, hey, wait a minute, there's a lot of pollution in this river, and it shouldn't be like that. It's a lot of pollution. But you know, if you're a Hindu, you're not going to worry about the pollution, because if it's divine, the river is going to, you know, clean itself. You know, it's going to clean itself. So in fact, the body of the Hindus, when they go to the Ganges River, you know, they take a dip, they get in the river. They also, you know, take drops of water and drink it. They're not afraid, because they think it's divine. Okay? And, you know, something else they do is they believe that what they do is they burn their, you know, the bodies of their loved ones to ashes, you know, on the shores of the river, and then they just drop the ashes on the river. So, but I think they also drop the, you know, the corpses and so on. So there's a lot of decomposing bodies in the river, Ganges. So it's a big deal. But it has to do with nature as well. That's the point I was trying to get. So a lot of things, nature, that's how, you know, the core of it, okay? And then, so it's a lot of nature worship. Okay, but today, you know, Hindus, although there's millions of deities or gods in Hinduism, there's three that are the most prominent. One of them is Vishnu. Let's see. Okay. Vishnu, along with, I remember the name. Okay. Brahma. Okay. Let me see if I have the third one here. Okay. Yes. And Shiva. Okay. Okay. Here we go. Okay. So those are the three. Okay. You know, if you go to India, or if you visit a Hindu temple here in the States, you're going to see in India most of the temples are dedicated to Vishnu or to Shiva, okay? Now, if you go to India, and most of the Indians being Hindus, there's going to be temples all over the place. So there's going to be temples dedicated to specific deities. Maybe you go to a temple and it's one temple dedicated to Vishnu, one temple dedicated to Shiva, one temple dedicated to Brahma, and so on. But in the States, since there's not as many temples as India, when you have a temple, you try to make most of the space, so you have several deities in that temple. Okay? And most likely, you're going to have all these three, plus other ones. Okay? And then I'll try to explain that as we get there. But, let me see. Let me show you. Let's see if I can... I know this is big enough, but let me see. But Vishnu is a god of love and benevolence, okay? He sustains the world. Okay? And then Brahma is the creator of the world, okay? And then, as you see, as they separate, you know, different characteristics, you know, from among the gods, you're going to see that Brahma has not much to do right now. See, because he already created the world. See? The other ones who are working now are, you know, the sustainer of the world. And then Shiva is the destroyer, but also, let's see, okay, reproduction and destruction. But I'm going to point out the destruction side. Okay, you see, so Brahma created the world, Vishnu sustains it, and then Shiva one day will destroy it. And she's also the god of reproduction, but also of destruction. All right, so those are the three main Hindu deities. Let me see. You tell me this if this works or not. Let's see, this is, you know, a rendering of Vishnu. Okay, you know, pictures. And then, let's see. Here is this. This is Shiva, right here. And you see, and they're not necessarily tied to one gender, okay? But where here Shiva is portrayed as a man, okay? And something I found about Hinduism is there isn't, they're not, in their history, or you know, the Upanishads, you know, there's more a lot of epics and stories. You may see one princess married to five princes, okay, I mean, male princes. You see, and yeah, as you see, these deities is usually female, male and female. That's how I find that something interesting. There's no homosexual deities, so I guess that's significant. That's a key point for us to look at. So this is this guy with the three heads. This god is Brahma. Okay, he's a creator. And you see, there's very little, you know, very, I mean, not very many temples dedicated to him. There's more to Vishnu and Shiva. Okay, now very interesting that the rest of the deities are in some way, or some, or most of them are some way related to all of these three, okay, which in a way they're called the Hindu Trinity, okay? So, for instance, I don't know if you've seen this one before, and see if we can see it better like this. He's very popular in India, okay? This is Lord Ganesha, okay? And this is this elephant head is the offspring of Shiva, and Shiva and his wife, her name is, let me see here. Well, I'll show you the picture in a moment. But he's the god of new beginnings, okay? So you see, you know, big parades in India carrying this Ganesh, you know, in the front, and guy of remover of obstacles. So you see how he can be very popular. Remover of obstacles and also the new beginnings god. But anyways, so we have, this is Ganesha. There's another one, let's see. This is Rama. And he comes from an epic also, from the Upanishads, okay? And so he's a hero. He basically rescues a princess and so on with the help of this monkey god with him. And Rama, he's the hero. And, okay, let me move on. This is Krishna, okay? This is another popular, okay, deity. And, you know, she's playing a flute. Yes.
One day, a good friend of ours, yes, Pastor Rodriguez, was in San Francisco.
Okay.
Because he lives in Fremont, which is about 45 minutes away. And he went into a place of business that was ran by Hindus. And there was a Hindu god on the counter.
Yes.
And he said to the clerk, he said, "Who is that?" He said, it's the Hebrew Hindu god Ganesh.
Okay.
And so Joshua asked him, "How do you know that's what Ganesh looks like?" And the guy said something interesting. He said, "You just have to believe it by faith."
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of laughed at that, like, by faith. And so we would understand faith come by hearing by the word of God. It would have been interesting if he would have asked him, "So how do we get that faith?"
Mm-hmm.
You know. So, but I just want to bring that up because when you brought that up, my mind went back to that. I'm,
yes,
like, well, that's interesting.
Of course, yeah. There's some points, you know, of contact that we have that we can, you know,
yeah,
take advantage of as,
yeah,
we, as we, you know, reflect in this religion. But anyways, moving along. This is, let me show you here. This is Vishnu and his wife Parvati. You see, as I mentioned, Vishnu, one of them, right here, sustainer, and his wife Parvati, and then Ganesh on her lap, one of her children, okay. And this is another of the children, a war god. You see, his different heads, okay. So two children that they have, okay. So you see, some of the deities, some of the most common names that come after these three are either offsprings or their wives, you know. They're related in some way or another to the other, you know, to the main prominent gods. Okay? Let's see. And this last one, this is the goddess of wealth and prosperity. And this is the wife of, let's see, Lakshmi. This is her name, Lakshmi. Okay? And then, let's see if I have one last one. And this is Saraswati. Okay? This is wife of the creator, Brahma. Okay, this is her wife. I mean, excuse me, his wife, and she's the god of knowledge, music, and arts. Okay, so you see, they divide, you know, different characteristics. And by the way, let me see if you can see this. This is Ganesh in a statue form at a temple at Memphis. Okay, I don't know if it's, you know, might not be big enough, the picture. I took this picture, and, you know, if you go, you'll walk in a Hindu temple. Let's see if you can see this one. This is more taken, you know, back from the floor. I was going to be trying to be discreet, not disrespectful, because I don't think they, you know, they, anyways, but if you, this is a Hindu temple in the States. So you see, you're going to see as you go in the Hindu temple here in the States. Let me see where, okay, here. So usually, you know, because of the space, like I mentioned, you're going to have several deities in one temple. Okay. So you're going to have here in the middle, usually it's going to be Vishnu right in the middle. And then next to it is going to be Shiva. Okay. And then Lakshmi, the one I mentioned. So you see, they're all three right there. Now, if you go around the temple, which is usually a big square, open square, and the deities are on the, you know, around you, so you can get a glance of all of them at the same time. Again, Vishnu, you know, with all the ornaments and pictures and so on, I mean, and garlands that they put around them and so on. Okay, and there's another picture of Ganesh, you know, a little bit more from away.
Let me ask a quick question.
Yes.
Since there are three primaries, like the Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva, do they recognize them as being like superior deities over the others?
That's a good question. Well, some accounts, you know, believe that there's, you know, there's different accounts. One of them believes that Vishnu and Shiva created Brahma, and then in turn he created the world. But then Brahma, the other account is that Brahma just created the world, he already existed. But to answer that question, let me explain something right here real quick. And hopefully I think this will answer the question. What they believe, and I'm going to raise this. This is part of the class too. Let me mention it right here.
I mean, we're dealing with 330 million?
Yes.
Deities? That's got to get real specific, like, you know, the deity of your big toe or something.
Yeah, so you see, don't confuse these two, okay? This is a god. But for Hindus, this is the ultimate reality, okay? Which is called Brahman, okay? Ultimate reality. So this is like the ocean, okay? If you want a picture, this is like the electricity running in the room, okay? Brahman, okay? And then what happened is, when we, you know, well, this is an individual right here, okay? This could be another individual, okay? But in reality, every person, this is what they believe, every person has a measure of Brahman, which they call Atman. Okay, every person. So, every, you know, all those 330 million gods are but, you know, representations of this bigger truth, which is Brahman. Okay, they're like representations. Now, so, you know, they believe in the writing that weak mind, as weak minded as we are as men, we need to see things, we need to picture things. So we make these representations of this bigger reality, which also are also divine. Okay? So the most important, all of them should be on the same, you know, one has different role than another one, but all of them should be on the same level, except the Brahman, which is the ultimate reality where every manifestation of all those gods come from here. Now when we talk about human beings, ourselves, and well, of course deities, but we have Atman, which is from this divine ultimate truth, we have a little piece of that in ourselves. You see, if you go to a yoga place where, you know, maybe the teacher believes in Hinduism, they're going to say goodbye or hello with the word namaste. Okay, you might have heard that word before. Yeah. That means I bow to the divine in you. That's what it means. It comes from Sanskrit. Okay? And I guess, you know, it's taken in other sense to say hello, only hello, how are you doing? Namaste. Okay, but it literally means I bow to the divine in you, to the Atman, to the peace of Brahman that you have in your in yourself. Okay, now something else, something important for us to think about is that everything we see, you see, you know, the building, the table, even myself, my ego, my emotions, everything is an illusion. Okay, it's an illusion because it's not the ultimate reality. The ultimate reality is here. So that illusion, they call it the Maya, okay? It's the illusion, okay? So I'm an illusion, this person is an illusion, this other person is another illusion, okay? So everything is an illusion except this ultimate reality, okay? Now, they also have something that they call, you know, what happens when this person dies, okay? Well, his Atman goes back to the Brahman, But then it comes back again. See, and in other words, it's basically the reincarnation. That's what they believe, reincarnation. So you keep on reincarnating, and they call this a samsara. Okay? These are words that are, you know, in one way or another, you know, popular. Okay? So this is the cycle of reincarnation, samsara. Now the goal is, you know, in life, is to get out of this circle and go back into the ocean. Okay? Not as a drop. See, they say this is a drop of water. This is the ocean. But you want to go back into the ocean and not just be one drop of water with the ocean, but to dissolve in the ocean. That you become Brahman yourself. Okay? You escape this cycle. Okay? Now, what dictates what I'm going to be born in the next life around is the word karma. Okay? This is also very popular. Okay? So, if I do good deeds, I'm going to reincarnate the next time around in a better person, or, you know, higher in the
higher form,
in the society ladder. Okay, and if I'm an evil person, and I'm gonna you know, be reborn in a lesser, you know, social class, and then it depends on what I did, I can be even go down to be an animal. Now someone might say, okay, I was born in a low class. I don't like it. I'm going to kill myself so I can be born somewhere else. Somebody else. You see, maybe somebody can take that. Well, they believe suicide is the worst of sins. And if you commit suicide, you're going to start from scratch. You're going to go all to the lowest of the classes, you know, even the lowest of the animals. And you're going to have to make your way up. And besides that, it's going to take you thousands of years to get back to where you were before. So that's how they explain suicide, you see. And then one last thing. They also, because of the social class, they have also something else that they call the Dharma. And this basically means, I'm going to fulfill my duty. Okay, so they believe in the caste systems, okay, and there's four main caste systems, and those caste systems then are subdivided into other groups. So if I was born in a certain caste system, and my parents are carpenters, my duty, since I was born, is to be a carpenter. So I must stick with it for the rest of my life. And no questions asked, no complaints, but just stick with that, the Dharma. Do your duty, okay, in your caste system that you were born. Just keep on doing it. So that's the main basic concepts of Hinduism. But let me see, let me get back here to the notes and
let's see.
Yes.
When you went over karma,
yes,
it made me think about how some people have misused that term.
Okay.
From an English perspective.
Correct.
You know, and so they view karma, from what I've gathered over the years, okay, this happened to you, so it's coming back on you. But that's not how they're using it.
Yes.
They're using it in a totally different way as it relates to, okay, I live this particular way, and so when I die, I'm going to come back.
It accumulates. Yeah.
Americans have taken that term.
Yes.
And really, if I can use it this way, they have defiled it.
Correct.
From a Hindu perspective.
Yes.
Like you use the idea of go around, come around.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So we're spitting these words out that really, from a Hindu perspective, well, that's not how it began.
Correct. Now, speaking about these beliefs, there was a man, you know, prominent reformers or prominent Hindu people. One of them was, his last name was Roy, okay? He was born 1972 to 1833, And he challenged some of these beliefs. You know, he challenged the belief in the caste system, because this caste system is an excuse to discriminate. See what I'm saying? There's some people that are called the untouchables, which are the lowest of the lowest, like maybe, you know, slumdog people and so on. And, you know, it's part of the caste system. They're not even allowed to be in Hindu temples because they're, you know, called untouchable. So he challenged those thoughts. There was another, you know, there's several traditions from Hinduism that, you know, have been, you know, done away as time went on. For instance, the widow burning. I don't know if you heard that or not, but this man, Mr. Roy, challenged the widow burning, which means that if a man dies, you know, the tradition is to burn the body and put it in the river. You know, the tradition was that the widow had to jump in the fire, kill herself because of his, you know, the disease of her husband. So he challenged that, and it was, you know, done away. It's not longer practiced, at least not legally in India. Okay, and you know, there's some other things, but one of the most important, you know, is Mohandas Gandhi. Okay, and Mohandas Gandhi, you know, he fought for the civil rights. You see, the caste system can, you know, be used to violate rights of, you know, some of the lowest of the classes. So he fought for that, and also independence from the British by peaceful. And in fact, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. later, you know, he recognized the civil rights movement in India as being an idea for the civil rights movement in the United States. So it was a peaceful civil rights movement, peaceful disobedience. That's what, you know, Gandhi. And then he later, because of what he did, he earned the title of Great Soul of Mahatma. That's how we know him better. Mahatma Gandhi. Okay. But anyways, you know, he was killed in 1948 by Hindu nationalists, and they still stick to the Hindu nationalists, and there's a national, there are nationalist parties, and they oppose Christianity very openly, and so on and so forth. But anyways, so we're explained that those beliefs, the Vedas, the Upanishads. In the Upanishads, there's a couple of epics. Okay, one of them is called the Mahabharata, which is the Mahabharata. It's 10 times our Bible. So it's a long epic. Okay, it's a lot of stories, and a lot of the, you know, ideas, you know, come from those. You see, the Vedas tell you what to do, what to say, and things like that. But just these epics, you know, this Upanishads and the Mahabharata, and there's another one called the Ramayana, another you know epic, which is also, you know, a good bit of a read. And there's myths and so on and so forth. But one of those, you know, in the Mahabharata, we have one that is called the Bhagavad Gita, okay? And this Bhagavad Gita is a section of one of these bigger epics. But in the Bhagavad Gita, why is this book significant? Because it's one of the most translated books in the world. It's about the size of the New Testament. Now let me put this in perspective. The Bhagavad Gita is the second most translated, okay, let me make it clear, translated, not in print, but translated book other than the Bible. That makes sense, okay? And it's about the size of the New Testament, it's not a big, long overread. But in that, in the Bhagavad Gita, you're going to see a story of, you're going to see Krishna, which is a prominent name, okay? And there you're going to see... But well, anyways, what happens is, let me tell you the gist of the story. There's a prince, okay? And the prince is going to war. And as he's going to war, according to the Bhagavad Gita, he's going to fight, has to fight against another family, which includes some of his cousins, okay? So he's hesitant. You know, he was born in the caste system, which are warriors. So he has a horse rider. You know, he's riding. You know, he's driving his horses, and then he asked to Krishna. I say, hey, what about what should I do? I don't want to kill my own family members. And then Krishna begins to talk to him about the dharma. So you need to fulfill your duty, okay? keep in mind samsara, if you kill them, they're going to come back, they're going to disappear. See what I'm saying? So she starts, I mean, this Parhid, rather, starts talking about these main concepts that we know here. And this is the core, this discourse, or this response from Krishna, which turned out to be an incarnation, or, you know the word avatar, you know, from the movie? Well, avatar is also a word used in Hinduism, which means reincarnation. Okay, that's what it means. So Krishna, the rider of the horse, turned out to be an avatar of Vishnu. And so all of these concepts that Krishna is talking about, they're the core of Hinduism. And it's in this book that is very much translated into different languages. Okay? And I hope that makes sense. But
Raphael?
Yes.
It's funny because I was looking that up.
Yes.
20 minutes ago.
Okay.
Across avatar, I threw it at the admin. And the first thing came to my mind was, I wonder how many Americans understand the Hindu background and saturation of that movie. Because it's not of us.
Yes.
It's not Christian whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, because they look like people, but they're not people.
Yeah.
And so, again, it's another way of our minds being influence.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is really good information.
Okay, I hope this helps. I don't want to run out of time, but anyways, those are the main beliefs we have. We've seen the main text, some of the main deities. So we have karma, reincarnation, samsara. Let's see. Now, if you ask a Hindu, okay, what were you in your other life? They're going to say, I don't know. Okay, and that's the question. So it's a question we don't even have to ask, because they're going to say, I don't know. Okay, and so there's no point going there, try to make an argument with them, because they're going to just say, I don't know, but I believe in it. Okay, I know I'm going to be in another life, and now I've been somebody else before. So this law of karma explains the inequalities of life. Even if you suffer, you're not destined to suffer forever. Because you're going to eventually, you know, be born in another life, or maybe go back to Brahman, okay? And there's no more suffering, okay? And then something very interesting. If every person, see, is an expression of Brahman, now the question is, so technically it should be about, you know, always the same number of persons. Again, you die, you come back, you die, you come back, see what I'm saying? Like, you know, how do you explain the increasing world population? Okay, that's something that, you know, comes to mind as you think of that. Well, you know, they're going to tell you, okay, so if this is the ocean, how many drops of water are in the ocean? And you say, well, there's an unlimited number of drops of water. So in other words, there's some who are recycling, as I understand it, and there's some who come right new from Brahman.
And it would seem to me that if we're just all illusions, then at some point in time, Brahman could just quit thinking of us and we're just gone.
Sure. That's a good point.
I mean, who was the philosopher that said, I think, therefore I am? The car, maybe. I don't remember who he was for sure. But that's one of the arguments about this concept that God is just, you know, we're just manifestations of his thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if ever just quits thinking, we'll just be gone. And the argument came back, but no, wait a minute. I can't be an illusion because I have the ability to think and process information. You know, therefore I actually do exist.
Correct.
But that right there would actually have Brahman at some point in time, you're just gone. We might all be sitting there looking at you, and all of a sudden you just disappear before our eyes.
And let me make 2 points before I forget. You know, you see how in Christianity there's a lot of, you know, debates. And think about, you know, in the broader term of the name, as far as the nature of God. You see, there's a lot of, you know, scholars who debate the nature of God, whether some believe it's just one person, some believe there's three persons. The Bible teaches there's three persons in one nature. Anyway, there's also scholars that debate, you know, Hindu scholars that debate the nature of Brahman, and, you know, those questions come across. But going back to the illusion of things, this Maya illusion, now what keeps a Hindu from saying, okay, this is illusion, why do I have to take it seriously anyways then? Yeah. If I'm an illusion, why don't I just go across the street in front of that illusionary car and just step in the middle of it and everything has an illusion? See, that makes sense. Well, the way you answer that question is in two ways, okay? You say, if it's an illusion, why take it seriously? Well, because there is the principle of dharma, your duty, okay? You play by the rules, you do your job, you feed your family, you do what you have to do, and just you keep in with your duty. Now, the other opposite answer to this question is what is called a renouncer. Okay, renouncers, and now this is going to probably hopefully make sense to you. You're going to see people in India who they leave the cities, leave the towns, they go live in, like asceticism. If that makes sense, you know, someone who renounces the world and lives his life doing what? Meditating. Okay, I'm staying away from the illusion. I'm just going to meditate and be here on my own, you know, with fellow men who think the same way I think. And these are called renouncers. You're going to find those in India as well. There's two extremes, the dharma, which is your duty, and the renouncers. Okay? And this is the alarm. I didn't want to go beyond the time. So let me see if I forget anything else. So we saw the caste system. There's four major caste systems.
Caste.
I don't know, I wrote C-A-S-E, that's why I was being thrown off. Caste systems. Yes, man, thank you. Okay, and basically this word caste comes from the Portuguese caste, which just means lineage or race, okay? And let's see, I'm just wrapping it up. Let me see if I forget anything. All right, so we looked at the Bhagavad Gita. Okay, let me finish with this before I forget. If you think about the holidays, and you have so many deities, you can get a calendar full of holidays. Well, there's three main, I want to finish with this, the three main holidays that they celebrate, you know, and also known worldwide. And Diwali is the first one, Diwali. So this holiday is a festival of lights. It basically celebrates the victory of lights over darkness, okay? And they have their respective Hindu and deities who conquered, you know, a certain evil deity. But anyways, this Diwali, you know, it's kind of like Christmas. All the houses are full of lights, you know, and the businesses are full of lights, and you're going to see lights, you know, everywhere. And something that they also do, they shoot fireworks and they exchange gifts.
Do you know when that is?
In the fall.
It's in the fall.
It's in the fall, and then they exchange gifts, and then don't necessarily have to be wrapped gifts. You know, the neighbor might knock on your door and say, "Here, here's some goodies for you to eat." You know, exchange that type of gifts, and they also, you know, with sand, you know, color sand, they make lotus flowers on the floor, colorful, in front of the door, which means you're welcome to come in, okay, or whatever. That's one of the biggest holidays that they celebrate. And then they also have the Holi. This Holi, you might not know the name, but this is the festival where they celebrate the starting of the spring, okay? And then there's a demons that were defeated. Holika is a demoness, rather, that was defeated. And then the faithful who defeated her, they went back to be faithful to Lord Vishnu, okay? So they celebrate this they go parading in the streets, you know, throwing in the air color power. You see, you know, you've seen in the videos, you know, these colorful, you know, people just throwing colors, you know, powder of different colors or water with different colors, and everybody just, you know, immersed in all of those colors. That's Holi. And, you know, it's celebrating the spring. And then, yeah, Holi. It's a Hindu, you know, holiday. And then the last one I wanted to mention, it's the Kumbh Mela. This Kumbh Mela, the book where I've read this information, it says the Kumbh Mela is celebrated every 12 years, okay? But other places that I listened to, it said every 6 years. So I just need to check that fact again. But this Kumbh Mela is a pilgrim, okay, to a city on the Ganges River. Well, I erased it already. And it's believed to be, you know, the official site of the Kumbh Mela, okay, believes that there's, or they put the number that there's 120 million pilgrims going back and forth for that festivity. And what they believe is on the Ganges River, at that time, there's special nectar or that the gods put on the river, and it's extra special that you dip yourself in that water. So you're going to see a lot of pilgrimages being done in those times, okay, in that festivity, Kumbh Mela, the Holi, and the Diwali, okay? And then lastly, three ways they can get to, you know, they can get make it to Brahman. There's three ways, main ways they can make it. One of them is the way of works, which means you follow the books by the letter, you do your rituals, you go to the temple, you celebrate the festivals, and then you're going to be on your way to Brahman, okay? One of these times you reincarnate, or maybe you won't reincarnate the next time. The other way is the way of knowledge, and it has to do with the Upanishads, which I mentioned were the philosophical writings, and that's another way you can, you know, make it to Brahman. And the last way is the way of devotion, okay? And all of these have the word yoga, okay, in it. You know, the way works is a karma yoga. The way of knowledge is a jnana yoga. And then the way of devotion is the bhakti yoga. Okay, yoga does not mean for them, you know, the stretches we do, but it means the way. Okay, the way of works. The way of knowledge or the way of devotion. And the way of devotion basically means that you're going to pick one of these deities and you're going to dedicate yourself to that deity. You're going to devote yourself to that deity. Not at the exclusion of the other ones. You're free to, you know, worship the other ones, but you're going to dedicate to one of these, and then that's the way of devotion, you know. Dedicate your life to them. And then one of these days, hopefully, you won't be reincarnated anymore, but going back to the Brahma. And then finally see the ultimate reality. Escape. Because this samsara is not something that is, you say, oh, I'm really enjoying this or whatever. It's something that is necessary. You have to do it. It's unavoidable. Okay? But anyways, I hope that, you know, it gave you more questions about the topic and want to study more. But thank you for your questions, your comments. Appreciate your time.